What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on this Tuesday afternoon. Very glad to have you with us. This is the program for our non-Catholic listeners, those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith. Maybe you don't know where to turn to get those answers that you're looking for. Well, that is why we are here. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question about the Catholic Church, why does the Church teach what it teaches, and why does it not teach other things that maybe you hear about in other churches? Well, let's get those answers for you. 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, and once you get it, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. You can also send us an email if that is how you would rather go. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer. Matt Kabinski is our phone screener. Rich Jesse handling social media for us today. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the chat screen, if you would, and then Rich will see it. We'll get it here to the studio, and off we go. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I'm groovy. How are you?
I don't know, swell. Seems to follow up on groovy quite well.
I like that. Here's a question that came in from Lynette a couple of days ago on YouTube. Lynette says, with limited times for weekly confessions, is the Church leaning towards scheduling appointments to receive the sacrament of reconciliation?
Thanks. I appreciate the question.
You heard anything about that?
Yeah. Well, is the I mean, when we talk about the Church, are we talking about like the Church universal, like tending to favor the scheduling of appointments? I mean, I think that'd be a little bit of a stretch to conclude that. I mean, it might be the case that in some particular parish, that would be the pastor's preference. I kind of doubt it, though. When I just think about the life of your typical parish priest, you know, I don't think he's necessarily looking for more opportunities to put stuff on his calendar.
Yeah, probably not.
And so, you know, I think there can be a variety of reasons why a particular parish would have, say, reduced hours available for confession. And they could range from, maybe in this particular parish there hasn't been that much demand. In my experience, generally, if there's not a lot of demand for the confessional, it's usually because the pastors haven't preached it up, you know, and generally, I mean, I know in my own diocese, there are some parishes where there's not much of a line, and there are other parishes where the line is out the door.
Yep.
But if you start looking at who's in the line out the door, sometimes it's the guys that go to the parishes without the lines, you know, so people will be attracted to a particular confessor, right? But in my experience, the general practice has been, you know, the Kevin Costner model of if you offer it, people will come.
Yeah.
Right? And then if you make confession available and you make it a priority, and you mention it and you talk about its necessity in the Catholic life, people will go to confession.
Well, very good. Lynette, thank you so much for your question via YouTube. This is one that came in a couple of days ago, and we didn't have time to really answer it fairly because we were out of time. So we're going to hit it again. This is from Desmond. What is the Church's teaching on predestination, and am I free to disagree with it?
Yeah, thank you very much. So I got a big chuckle out of that question
last time we asked you.
Because of the double entendre involved in the question, am I free to disagree with it? Because
yeah.
At least on some accounts of predestination, if one is predestined, one is consequently not free, right?
That's right.
But that's not the sense that he means.
No.
He means, does your Church require me to subscribe to that teaching? That's
right,
what he
right.
means. Okay. So there, the concept of predestination is a biblical idea. I mean, the phrase occurs in sacred scripture. you know, we learn that Christians are predestined, but what exactly does that mean? Okay. Here's what the church says that you have to believe, and then there's other things you don't have to believe. You have to believe that all of history, including the history of individual souls in their progress towards God, falls within the scope of divine providence. And so God does orchestrate the outcome of human events, including the outcome of your free human choices.
Mm.
Okay. The church teaches that you cannot be saved without God's grace and that you cannot merit the initial gift of grace. So if God has given you grace, it is not because you deserved it. That's an oxymoron. That's a contradiction in terms. It's his gracious initiative to give you grace.
Okay.
That you must cooperate with grace to be saved. But again, that cooperation is not itself because you're such a great guy, right? It's enabled by God's grace that you cooperate. Although there is synergism there. It's God's initiative and your cooperation. That you must persevere in God's grace, and that presupposes your free cooperation, and that perseverance is itself a result of God's grace. And so if you in fact persevere to the end of your days, it is not because you're such a great guy, but God has granted you the gift of perseverance. It is obvious that not everybody perseveres. It's obvious that not everybody cooperates. And so the question comes in, well, so, you know, how do you decide, you know, how do you understand the basis on which God grants this salvific grace to some and not to others? Well, the church teaches also that God offers sufficient grace to everyone that they might be saved. And it teaches that grace can be resisted. Those are all dogmatic claims of the Catholic Church. But that still leaves a lot of wiggle room. And so there are Catholics who say, well, you know, God gives efficacious grace, grace that gets the job done to some based on some inscrutable reason of his own providence that we don't understand. There are others that say, no, God grants that efficacious grace because he foresees how we will or will not cooperate. Those are really completely opposite positions.
Yeah.
And they're both allowable in Catholic terms. Now, what the church condemns, what it rejects in, say, the Protestant or Calvinist doctrine of predestination is the idea of double predestination, that God predestines people to damnation. It condemns the idea of irresistible grace, and it condemns the idea of infallible knowledge of one's future justification. Those are all doctrines that it rejects.
Desmond, thanks so much for your email. In a moment, we'll talk with Mark, Brian, Jason, and Peter. Still room for you at 833-288-EWTN. It's Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Before we get to the phones, let me tell you about a wonderful program we have that's a great way to kick off your weekend. It's EWTN News in Depth. We bring you that Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern. It covers the underreported stories and clarifies the church's position on key teachings with a focus on the laity's needs and concerns. Catherine Hadro does such a fantastic job on EWTN News in Depth. Again, that's Friday at 8 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio and Television. And by the way, you can get EWTN News in Depth content delivered to your email inbox with details on each week's show. Go to EWTN.com/in-depth. Sign up for that today. It's a great show. All right, if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Mark in Barrie, Illinois, watching us today on YouTube. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today, sir?
Concerning the U.S. military bombing Venezuelan drug boats, they hit four of them yesterday. How is a Catholic to understand this in the light of justice? We do not hear that the boats are warned to stop in any way. If they shoot at the military first, were they given a warning shot, you know, across the bow? As a retired state trooper, it was drilled into us that we needed probable cause, and we responded with force that was only necessary to stop the suspect. When we did drug interdiction on the highways, even with probable cause, you know, information, we didn't blow up the car when it came by. And, you know, I understand that things are different under maritime law and international law, et cetera. But I'd be interesting to hear what you would have to say about that.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So to begin with, and this is, anything I say should not be construed as either defense or criticism of the federal policy, all right? So I'm not taking a political or a policy position in what I am observing. To begin with, it seems to me, and this is my personal opinion, not necessarily like the dogmatic Catholic opinion, that there is a key distinction between civil police action and military action in the context of war, right? And in the context of war, you do not apply, you cannot, but it might not be possible to apply the same standard of civil liberties that you would apply in, say, working as a state trooper, right? The presumption of innocence, that's the cornerstone of our judicial system, strikes me as applied to individual combatants in a war zone is a criterion with no relevance. I mean, you know, how is it if there's a guy on the other side of the war zone who's got an AK-47 pointed at my head? You know, the question of his personal culpability for that act is irrelevant to me. I mean, this is an act of self-defense on my part, and I think I would be within my rights to assume that he intends aggression towards me and to take action accordingly, right? Or you know, even if he doesn't have an AK-47 pointed at my head, if he's, you know, he's in some sort of military transport belonging to the enemy that's in an active, you know, state of war with the United States or whatever country I'm from, then it's a different evaluative criteria brought to bear in war than in civil police actions. That being said, how would you evaluate this particular instance? So what the Catholic Church says about the legitimacy of war, and if I understand the administration's position, it's said essentially that we are what is tantamount to a state of war with South American drug cartels. Now, that's a judgment call, and you might dispute that, but that's the position, the justification I think the administration is using. And in order to justify any stance of war towards an aggressor, the church says here are the criteria that have to be met. First of all legitimate means for resolving this conflict have to have been tried and failed. Every other option has to have been shown ineffective.
Okay.
The aggressor, if you conceive that you're in an act of self-defense, the aggressor against you must be threatening damage that is lasting, grave, and certain. You have to have serious prospects of success in your military action, and your use of arms can't produce evils greater than the evil that you're seeking to eliminate, right? So those are the basic elements in evaluating a just war, and the evaluation of those conditions belongs to the prudential judgment of those who have the responsibility for the common good, right? So it's not for private citizens to make the ultimate determination about whether or not a particular conflict meets the criteria. I mean, clearly I could make that in my own case, and that might be the basis for my being a conscientious objector. But when it comes to, you know, the action taken at the level of the government, there are people who in the government who have the care of the common good, and it is incumbent upon them to use their prudential judgment to determine mm-hmm. whether or not the conflict meets those standards. And so that's the kind of criteria that you would bring to bear. Now, thank God, I am not in the position of having the care of the common good and having to make those judgment calls.
Absolutely. Hey, Mark, thanks so much for your call today from Illinois. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Couple lines open for you on this Tuesday afternoon edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go now to Brian. Brian is a first-time caller from Washington, D.C., listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hi, good afternoon. I have a very specific question. That is recounting probably the most profound statement, or one of the most profound statements that Jesus says in the Gospels is, "Today you will be with me in paradise," when he's referring to the good thief. When the good thief asks him, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." And so when Jesus said, "Today you will be with me in paradise," how should we interpret that? Because, you know, as we know, he went, descended into the dead and rose again on the third day.
Right. So the church would say that St. Dismas was with Christ in the limbus of the fathers when Christ ascended to the dead to liberate the souls of the old covenant who were waiting for the coming of the Messiah. And then with them, he would have ascended to the beatific vision at the ascension of Christ.
Does that answer your question, Brian?
Yes, it does. So it's kind of a much broader interpretation then.
It depends on what you mean by paradise. I mean, it doesn't mean the full enjoyment of the beatific vision.
Okay.
Because that doesn't happen until Christ's ascension.
Brian, thanks so much for your call from D.C. Appreciate that. Here is Ron. Ron is in Fargo, North Dakota, listening on the great Real Presence Radio. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yeah, I just have a question about what St. Irenaeus meant when he said the glory of God is a man fully alive, and then how do we live that out?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So Irenaeus, in his soteriology, his doctrine of salvation, believes that that in Christ we regain what we lost in Adam, namely the likeness and image of God. And so it is the vocation of the human person to image, to reflect, to participate in the fullness of God's being. You know, not by identity, but by participation. And so the more sanctified you become, the more you reflect the beauty of God's character.
All right. Hey, Ron, thanks for checking in from Fargo. Appreciate hearing from you today on EWTN's Call to Communion. We got a couple lines open for you at 833-288-EWTN. Still plenty of time to get in. 833-288-3986. Here's a question now from Daniel, who's watching us this afternoon on YouTube. Why is the order of the Eastern Star considered evil?
Right. So the Order of the Eastern Star is a fraternal organization founded in the 19th century based on the principles of Freemasonry.
Okay.
And the principles of Freemasonry are incompatible with Catholic identity, right? It doesn't mean that anyone that belongs to such an order is themselves intrinsically evil, but it would not be permitted to a Catholic to join any kind of society whose principles were in direct contradiction to the teaching of the Catholic Church.
Okay. And Daniel, thanks for watching us today on YouTube. Dee sent us an email. Does Mary have any relation to the Eucharist? And is there a Eucharistic title for her?
Yes, well, she has a very intimate relationship to the Eucharist in that she is the God-bearer, that she gave birth to the God-man, whose flesh and blood are consumed in Holy Communion, right? And so every time you go to Holy Communion, every time you participate in the sacrifice of the Mass, you're sharing in the humanity of Christ, the body and blood of Christ, which are the fruit of Mary's womb. So it's kind of hard to avoid a pretty close connection there, right? Indeed.
Yeah.
You know, as far as historically knowing what was Mary's involvement historically in the liturgy of the Church, the data of divine revelation give us very little data about that. I'm trying to think. Tom, do you know any Marian titles of, you know?
I was trying to think of some now.
There are more Marian titles than, you know, there are, I don't know, you know.
And women named Mary.
Women named Mary, exactly. I mean, there's just this, there's so many. I just feel like in sacred tradition, in Catholic tradition, there's got to be some Marian Eucharistic titles buried out there someplace. But I can't think of any off the top of my head.
Well, very good. Appreciate that. Thanks so much for your email, Dee. Here is one now from Silva. Have decades of charismatic Catholic groups and liberation theology led Catholics to non-denominational Pentecostalism? It looks like this is the case in Brazil.
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. So I rather think that part of the motive for Paul VI to legitimize the use of charismatic spirituality within Catholicism was, in fact, to prevent that possibility, right? You know, the old, if you can't beat them, join them philosophy.
Ah.
And we found something quite similar in a small C charismatic movement in the 12th century, the mendicant movement, right? Mm. There was a movement in the Middle Ages of people who were embracing poverty and lay preaching the imitation of the apostolic form of life as an alternative to Catholic identity and as a way of thumbing the nose at Catholic hierarchy And the Waldensians would be an example of that. Thus, when Innocent III, Pope Innocent III, first encountered the character of Francis of Assisi, he was not inclined to look kindly on him because he assumed that Francis was just another one of those rabble-rousing types. And then, according to the story, Innocent goes to bed that night, has a dream in which God tells him Francis will rebuild the church, and he invites Francis back in and says, okay, you can do this thing after all, just, you know, maintain your fidelity to the church and to the hierarchy. And then, of course, what had really had an origin outside the hierarchical structure of the church, a social movement, got incorporated into Catholicism, and then the mendicant thing blew up and became huge and is one of the most characteristic or defining aspects of medieval Catholic culture, and clearly was responsible for many more people being incorporated into the church than going out of it, right? And so the fact that there is a Catholic charismatic movement, I suspect, has kept a lot of people in the church that might otherwise have gone out of it looking for charismatic experience. Now, to the question, has the Pentecostal movement worldwide done much to degrade Catholic identity and pull people out of the Catholic Church into non-denominational churches? The answer to that is emphatically yes. I mean, the defections from Catholicism for Pentecostal-type Protestantism in Latin America are mammoth. So there's no doubt that it has had an effect on membership in Catholic organizations and participation in Catholic liturgy. But, you know, is the Catholic embrace of the charismatic movement the culprit there? I rather doubt it.
Okay. Silva, thanks so much for your email. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Still time for your call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Interesting wording on this question. I'm sure you'll understand where this caller is going to, or this writer is going to. This is from Mark. Mark says, how can we worship in truth instead of going to church? What is this? What's he talking about?
Well, I think it's a false dichotomy, of course, right? So in John chapter 4, when Jesus meets the woman, the Samaritan woman at the well, and they get in a discussion about where you're supposed to worship, and she says, you Jews say we're supposed to worship in Jerusalem. Our fathers worship here on Mount Gerizim in Samaria. And Jesus responds and says, I tell you, woman, a time is coming when the Father will seek the true worshipers who worship him in spirit and in truth. Don't worry about worshiping on this mountain or on that mountain.
Okay.
And something very similar we find in St. Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 12, when he says, offer your bodies in living sacrifice. This is your rational act or your spiritual act of worship, right? So again, it's the self-offering in charity that constitutes the worship in spirit and in truth, right? Now, the question supposes that there is a kind of conflict between the worship in spirit and in truth and the liturgical worship of the Catholic Church. The Church obviously doesn't see it that way, and in fact, the Eucharist is often described in terms of St. Paul's rational worship, right? The latria logicae, that's the language in St. Paul's epistle. And why would that be, right? Because in the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, we have the ritualized offering of the body and blood of Christ that were shed for us at Calvary, and the Mass is the memorial of what happened at Calvary. That's the language the priest says. He says, this is the memorial of what happened at Calvary. And thus, it becomes instructive for us. St. Augustine once said to his church in a homily, become what you see. Right, in reference to the elements of the Eucharist. You know, you see Christ, the offering of Christ's body and blood. Yeah, go do that with yourself, you know. But imitate that, incorporate that into your own self-conception. And so, you know, where do you learn how to offer your body in living sacrifice but from the living bread that comes down from heaven that made his flesh food for and life for the world?
Yes, indeed. All right, and thank you so much for your question. It is Call to Communion here on EWTN. We're heading into the last half of the program. Time for your phone call, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, if you would prefer, text the letters EWTN to 58177 or send us an email, ctc@EWTN.com. Lots more straight ahead on the Tuesday edition of Call to Communion. Hey, what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic? Think about it and then call 833-288-EWTN. We'd love to chat with you this afternoon. 833-288-EWTN. 888-398-3986 for Call to Communion here on EWTN. Congratulations to another EWTN radio partner, Evangelist Radio, serving Somersville, West Virginia, celebrating 15 years with us this week. Congratulations to Jeff and Louise Molnar and their great team there at WSJE from your friends here at EWTN Radio. More calls coming in right now while we're getting those screened. Here's a question from Daniel. How can we consider Methodists to be Christian, considering that they openly support abortion and gay marriage?
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. First of all, I'm sure that there are some Methodists listening to this show right now that would take issue with everything that you just said,
yeah,
both about what Methodists support and your unwillingness to cede to them the name of Christian, right? The church's position is that all of the validly baptized are Christian. That is the position of the Catholic Church, that we dignify anyone who has been validly baptized with the name of Christian. Now, it goes without saying that not every Christian is a Catholic Christian, which is to say that some Christians have only elements of truth and sanctification, not the full package. If
okay.
you're Catholic, mm-hmm. hopefully you have the full package. Outside the Catholic Church, there are elements of truth and sanctification. So let's apply that to Methodists, okay? So the Methodist communion is big, it's diverse, and Methodists believe all different kinds of things. Let's take the part of Methodism that I think everybody agrees on. The Wesleyan hymn book with those magnificent hymns by Charles Wesley.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? Now, I'm a Catholic, but there are days when I want to throw out the Catholic hymn book and replace it with Charles Wesley. I mean, Charles Wesley was just an absolutely sublime, magnificent hymn writer. I mean, I don't think there's better in any language. They're just absolutely outstanding.
It's good stuff.
And let's say you have a particular moral position that's wrong, that's erroneous, right? Does that mean that the Methodist hymn book cannot be for you a means of sanctification and redemption? Of course it can. I mean, that's the teaching of the church, that there may be elements, admixtures of error in your religious tradition, but you've got elements of truth and sanctification. And those elements themselves are both forces impelling to Catholic unity, meaning if you follow them to their logical conclusion, you'll end up Catholic, and potentially means of sanctification and redemption. All right? So a person could definitely come into contact with those things and be edified by them, be sanctified by them. The impulse behind Methodism as a movement has always been one that values the goals of social reform and equity and social justice and things like that. It's been near and dear to Methodist hearts for a long time. And so clearly Methodists have done a tremendous amount of good in the world motivated by those impulses, right? Sometimes Methodists, and Catholics too for that matter, can come to bad moral judgments. They can misapply, you know, their rational faculties and be influenced by the wrong things and come to wrong decisions. And sometimes gravely wrong decisions, right? But it doesn't mean they're deprived of all means of sanctification and redemption.
Daniel, thanks so much for your email. By the way, if you would like to send us an email for a future show, we're always looking for them at ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Back to the phones now for Sarah in Wake Forest, North Carolina, listening on the great Divine Mercy Radio. Hey, Sarah, what's on your mind today?
Hey, so thank you so much for having me on.
Sure.
I have a question about my, so my sister is Catholic. They just welcomed their fifth baby. My brother-in-law is Lutheran. And they're so close, right? They're so close, but yet so far away from, and she would love for him to convert to Catholicism. And he seemed to be kind of getting there a little bit. And then they had asked my daughter to be godparent to their newest baby. My oldest is 14. She's in North Carolina. You receive a confirmation as starting as a sophomore in high school, usually. And so she's in classes. She's going to be confirmed probably in about a year and a half. So, you know, they talk to their priest and he's like, I'm sorry, you know, she has to have received confirmation. And they're like, well, do you think she could stand in and we can make it later? And he's like, no, we can't retroactively, you know, you do the sacrament. And it really just kind of set him off and was made him upset, and, you know, he's like, I don't understand. He's like, you know, it's just, it, and then he kind of did the whole, well, it's your religion. I guess, you know, we have to go by the rules. And so I'm trying to find a way to explain to him why the rules are in place for sacraments and not turn him off anymore from the Catholic faith.
Yeah.
I want him
so let me make sure I have the details right. So this is your, you said this is your Lutheran brother-in-law?
Yes.
And so your sister is Catholic?
Correct.
All right. And so the child will be baptized in the Catholic Church?
Yes.
Not, okay. All right. I just had to make sure it wasn't the Lutheran Church we're talking about. Okay. Right. So in the Catholic Church, for someone to be a godparent, they have to be at least 16 years old, and they have to be fully initiated into the Catholic Church, meaning they've received all the sacraments of initiation, and they have to live a life that's in harmony with Catholic faith and teaching. Now, that is an eminently reasonable set of criteria. And here's why it's eminently reasonable. What's the point of being a godparent? Well, you are to model the Christian life to the new child and be another adult person in that individual's life who can help them in their own Catholic growth and development. Well, obviously, you can't do that unless you yourself... You're not going to be a good example of a Catholic person unless you have a certain kind of maturity in Christian life and you're fully initiated into the Catholic faith. I mean, that just stands to reason. You know, I mean, like, I'm not going to go take a enroll in a martial arts class and ask, you know, for a white belt sensei. You know, I mean, it's just, it doesn't make any sense, right? You want someone who has some measure of maturity in the faith
sure.
to assume that role, right? And so it's not an arbitrary criterion at all, right? Now, I don't know what's motivating your brother-in-law. I mean, it may be that he sees this more as an opportunity to build familial ties and social networks, between family members, and that's also a goal. I mean, that's admirable, and there's nothing wrong with that. But maybe that's what's predominating in his mind more than, okay, is there an objective criteria here for being a model Christian person, right? And so those are the criteria, and that's why they're not arbitrary. I mean, you know, the church could set the standard differently. It could say, you know, you have to be 25 instead of 16, or you have to be 14 instead of 16. You know, it's settled on 16.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that's you know, probably not completely it's a little bit arbitrary. They could have made it 15 and a half. They could make it 16 and three quarters, you know, but they picked 16. You know, this is what you call positive law. I mean, you have to have some principle to govern life in society. Some of those judgment calls have to be made by competent authority. And, you know, it's just like the speed limit, federal speed limit on federal highway interstates is usually about 70 miles an hour. They could have made it 69 or 71, and we, you know, we wouldn't quibble. But no one thinks it's irrational that I won't say no one, but most people wouldn't think it's irrational that they made it 70 because there's some objective basis for understanding. You know, beyond a certain threshold, you risk the risk of injury goes up exponentially and so forth. So you need to have some kind of rational limit, and it belongs to the competent authority to do that. Well, the Catholic Church is the competent authority that polices, as it were, the interstates of grace that are the Catholic sacraments.
The interstates of grace. Man, okay, I got to remember
I'm
that.
I'm stretching for metaphors today, sorry.
Just a little bit. Sarah, is that helpful for you?
I would say, like, I guess he would point to some younger saints and that type of thing and wondering why there couldn't be the exception made. And I would say that his reasoning for wanting her is because he does see in her a really good example of what he hopes maybe his kids will turn into, and that's saying it humbly, like, I wish I was more like her when I was her age too. I'm not sure where she came from sometimes, but I understand, and that's why I understand that they have to have a rule, they have to have an age limit and so forth. But it's just, I guess, he just can't understand why they can't say, okay, well then in, you know, 1.5 years, can we make her the godmother? And right. For now, she'll just have a godfather type thing.
So I have a recommendation. All right. There's a provision in the church's teaching that you have to have at least one Catholic godparent. But you can have a non-Catholic Christian witness. So there's another category of thing, which is somebody who's not, who doesn't have the status of godparent, but does come up with the family for the baptism and is there as a, you know, a kind of a supporter and so forth. And they don't have the title godparent, but they have a role to play. And actually, when my fourth son was baptized in the Catholic Church, my best friend, who is today Catholic, was not Catholic at the time, and he was the non-Catholic witness. You know what we call him at the house? We call him the Godfather.
Of course.
Right? But
of
he course. Was the, because the, his role in my son's life is godfatherly, right?
Yeah.
You know, if I were your brother-in-law and you, what I would say is, look, you know, the church won't permit us to call her the godparent, but we'll get her up there anyway. She'll come to the ceremony. We will all understand that the intent is you want her to have a relationship of care and solicitude, and that will be for us to cultivate. So you can have your cake and eat it too.
There you go, Sarah. Thanks so much for your call from Wake Forest. It is called Communion here on EWTN. Still time for a couple more calls, a few more calls, if you will. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Hey, have you checked out EWTN Radio Extra? It's a whole nother platform, the past, present, and future of Catholic radio, where you'll hear classic programs from Mother Angelica, Dr. Scott Hahn, Father Benedict Rochelle, timeless devotionals, also award-winning podcasts from some of our partners on EWTN's Podcast Central. Check it out, EWTN Radio Extra. It's available for you on the EWTN app and at EWTN.com. All right, let's get back to it. Here is Kevin now in Virginia, listening on the EWTN app. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yeah, just a question for Dr. Anders. First off, just want to say thank you to both you guys for the ministry you do for all of us. My question is, in the Catechism, and I believe it's somewhere around 400, they're talking the divinity of Christ, and I'm paraphrasing the first part, but it says Christ came, but in quotes it says that we may become gods, and I just can't square that in my mind. If you can give me your take on that.
Absolutely. Thank you. What a fantastic question. So we're not talking about becoming God by way of personal identity with the Godhead, right? That we're not talking about that at all. We're talking about coming to have a godlike character. To reflect in God's character and likeness in our character. And here's how that shakes out in Catholic theology. So in the ministry of Jesus, you probably noticed this, that he spends a lot of time upending and reversing expectations. The first will be last, the last will be first. It isn't the self-righteous Pharisee who does all of the ritually correct religious stuff who is justified. It's actually the tax collector who beats his breast and says, "Have mercy on me, God, a sinner," who is justified. You know, it's not the religious establishment. It's the poor, the blind, the lame, the prostitute, the tax collector, the social outcasts who respond to Christ's message that he says, you know, these are my brothers and sisters. These are the ones that are dear to God's heart and so forth. And that's a hard message to get across to the people at the time. And so Christ teaches in parables, not because they're easy to understand. He says, I teach in parables, not because they're easy to understand, but because they're hard to understand. They're hard to assimilate because you find yourself within the logic of the parable, usually identifying with the bad guy, right? And it explodes your categories. And you come to realize, oh my gosh, I am that Pharisee. I am that self-righteous person. I am that religious hypocrite. And you have a kind of radical revaluation of the world and come to see reality through new eyes. This is one of the reasons why the Catholic Church places such a heavy emphasis upon suffering in the Christian life, because nothing will humble you and blast all your categories like suffering, right? And you know, when you really go through something terrible, you oftentimes come out the other side with a great deal more patience and empathy for other people who have gone through terrible things. And suddenly, the racial, social, economic, ideological divisions that you used to think marked out the good from the righteous from the unrighteous, the good people from the bad people, the right from the wrong, those things melt away in insignificance, and you realize that. That the heart of justice and charity is found much, much closer closer to the heart and less, you know, less bound up in our little petty party spirit. But it takes serious experience, a lot of suffering, heartache, you know, radical reconfiguration of my my being in the world to have that kind of enlightenment. And the church uses the language of enlightenment. And when you go through it, you come out the other side, and lo and behold, you're actually beginning to act and behave more like Jesus did. You know, Mother Teresa famously struggled with atheism, of all things. I mean, she told her spiritual director, you know, I'm kind of afraid maybe there's no God. But in that suffering that she had, what she did is she made it her life's mission to manifest the truth of the loving God in whom she had a hard time believing. Right? It wasn't so much about what she had in her head. It was how she manifested in her behavior. And it was because of her suffering, because of her alienation, because of her loneliness, because of her disillusionment, that she was able to turn that around into so much charity and so much kindness towards the other. You know, St. Paul, another great example, perfectly self-righteous religious hypocrite who actually goes out and kills people in the name of God. He's so sure of himself. And then his whole universe gets turned upside down. His whole universe gets turned upside down, and the people that he thought were unrighteous turn out to be righteous, and vice versa.
Yeah.
And he refers to this complete revaluation as coming to have the mind of Christ, right? St. Irenaeus said that we regain in Christ what we lost in Adam, which is to be in the likeness and image of God. So as we come to share Christ's perspective on the poor, the blind, the lame, the religious outcasts, and so forth, as we come to humble ourselves and give up our pretenses and our religious hypocrisy and to just stand naked and empty before God and in deep compassion to our suffering neighbor, well, the church says, you're on your way to theosis. You're on your way to actually reflecting, you know, the love of the God who causes the rain to fall on the righteous and the wicked alike.
Kevin, is that helpful for you?
That's perfect. That's the reason I call. I know you could come through.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate your call there, Kevin. Here is Michael now in Fargo listening on the great Real Presence Radio. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hello. Quick question about name changes in the Bible. Abraham was originally Abram, and then the rest of the time in the Bible, he's referred to as Abraham. Saul became Paul, but Jacob, even though his name was changed to Israel, when in later books it always says, I am the God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, why isn't he ever referred to as Israel?
Yeah, that's a great question. And of course, any answer I give you is purely speculative, because it's not like an index or a glossary at the end of the Bible that says, you know, let's explain this Bible difficulty, and it gives you the authoritative explanation. So I'm going to shoot from the hip here, right? So the patriarchal narratives in Scripture, you know, they're not just interesting historical episodes that took place to random people. These individuals are typological. They're understood in the history of Israel, the nation, as founders, and in their persons, in their personal history, you see represented the fate of a society, right? And so, as the Bible is coming to shape in the post-exilic period, the scribes that are compiling these ancient stories and texts into a coherent narrative are drawing on these things to create a national mythos, right? I didn't say myth in the sense of untruth. I'm talking about, you know, a story of the nation's founding and its origins. That's the way I'm using the terminology. Okay. They're drawing these stories to evoke a national mythos. And it is the story, I mean, this is historical. This is, you can see this in the archaeology, of a diverse group of tribes coming together to share a single historical identity, right? And so in history, you know, Israel means both the northern kingdom that was typically in conflict with the southern kingdom of Judah, and then it ultimately also comes to refer to the totality of what would be ruled over by the Davidic Empire, right? And so there's a distinction between, like, the geographical subdivision Israel, and then the imperial reality of Israel that would come to be, you know, ultimately stand for the totality. And within that subdivision of the northern kingdom of Israel, there are tribal distinctions that are represented by the 12 tribes. And so I think it makes perfect sense that in the narrative itself, these kinds of ethnic distinctions that are the experience of the formation of the empire would be reflected in the ambiguity of the names of the characters, right? So you're seeing political realities, you know, that emerged in the, you know, the 8th, 7th, 6th century BC, reflected in the stories of origin and the characters that stand at, as the typological heads for these tribes and nations that will ultimately emerge.
Michael, thanks so much for your call from Fargo. You've got a wonderful radio station there in town, Real Presence Radio. It's called a communion here on EWTN. This is a tough one, David. This is an email from Hilda. A family member told me she had a vision that I was going to have a baby and that she had seen the baby. She practices necromancy and other things. How can I speak to her about all this?
Here's what I would do.
Okay.
Here's what I would do. If a necromancer came up to me and said, I have had a vision of your future and here's what it looks like, I would smile, turn around, walk out the room, and do everything in my power to avoid that necromancer from here on out. I wouldn't engage it. I wouldn't refute it. I wouldn't accept it. I would ignore it and walk away from it, right? Honestly, I have no interest whatsoever at all in engaging with anybody who's trying to predict the course of my life through necromancy. Necromancy is absolutely forbidden by the Catholic Church. It is an immoral superstition. And I shouldn't give any credence to it whatsoever at all, right? And in my personal experience, when people are deeply superstitious and wound up in these kinds of practices, they're not interested in reasoning about them at all. They're really not. You know, I don't really see any sense in engaging in this. I mean, I don't want to have a dialogue. Now, you said if the person is someone with whom you have a historical relationship, maybe they're a family member and they're kind of unavoidable, and you have to give a response, I would just basically say, thanks, I'm not interested. I'm just not interested. That's, I don't believe in that, and I'm not going there. You know, thank you very much. I'll see you another time. Let's go eat pizza or something, but let's not talk about necromancy.
Hilda, thanks so much for your email. We'll close with this one from Jim. He says, it seems like at times men in Scripture need to be commissioned by Christ to cast out demons. But Jesus also says, whoever is not against me is for me. How can we reconcile these two positions?
Okay, so here's an analogy. There are certain situations in civil life when, let's say, you know, there's a criminal element that's wreaking havoc and private citizens are, you know, find themselves in the position where they can, you know, take this guy out and keep the peace on their own terms. Well, that does happen. That's an extraordinary situation, and it'd be much preferable to delegate it to the properly commissioned public authorities, namely the police, right?
Yep.
And in fact, you take that into your own hands, you can get in big trouble. You know, A, you can get yourself killed,
yep,
or worse, prosecuted, right? You know, if you do it the wrong way. And I think there's something analogous that we see in Scripture and in Catholic experience. Jesus does seem to hold out the possibility that that confronting demonic forces in a kind of spiritual warfare is theoretically possible to people who are not of the company of the disciples and don't possess the juridical authority of the church behind them. But the church, and the church recognizes this too and says, but that's really dumb. That's really dumb. Like, don't do that. You know, do not try this at home, ladies and gentlemen. Right.
Yeah.
And so in Catholic canon law, no one is authorized to attempt an exorcism unless they have specific jurisdiction from their bishop. They have to be a priest specifically commissioned by the bishop to do so, and that jurisdiction makes a difference.
Okay. And along those same lines, Marcy says in Mark 6, when Jesus says, whoever is not for me is against me, does this mean that all Christians are of equal knowledge?
Well, clearly they're not all of equal knowledge. I mean, I'm not of equal knowledge with myself. I mean, I know more tomorrow than I know today, and I know more today than I knew yesterday, you know. Just because I'm Catholic doesn't mean I know everything about being a Catholic. No, they're not all of equal knowledge.
Okay. Well, that's where we have to leave it. Marcy, thanks so much for your email. Thanks for all the questions that came in today. You know, we do this program Monday through Friday here on EWTN at 2 p.m. Eastern. We give you multiplicity. Is that a word? I think that's a word. Many different ways to contact the show. You can either phone us. We even give you two different phone lines to use, either in North America, outside North America. You can also text us. You can send us an email. You can contact us on YouTube. You can contact us on Facebook. My goodness, you know, Mother Angelica used to say, we have to, you know, be where the people are. And whenever a new platform comes out, like Facebook back in the day, or even email back in the day, we need to be all about it and look into those kind of things. So that's why we give you so many different ways to contact the show. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
Don't forget, again, we do it Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Check out the podcast whenever you wish at EWTN.com/podcasts. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow on the Wednesday edition of Call to Communion. God bless.